Good morning, everyone. My name is Ken Fellman. I am the president of NATOA, and I am really excited to welcome you to our annual conference. We put a lot of work into planning this conference, and I'm really excited about the programs that we have. Yesterday's pre-conference day was a great success for those of you who got here a little bit early. Let me go through a couple of procedural informational items before we get started with the presentations. First, I want to thank today's sponsors. Breakfast was sponsored by the NCTA. Lunch will be sponsored by Comcast. And our refreshment break is sponsored by Columbia Telecommunications Corporation. We have Wi-Fi available in the meeting rooms for the duration of the conference. It is sponsored by Light Squared, and the password to access the Wi-Fi should be Light Squared. No spaces, no capital letters. Light Squared. Once again this year, we have an exhibitor passport program. We have our exhibitors over here. Pick up a passport at the registration desk. Visit our exhibitors for stamps and return your completed passport to the registration desk, and you will be entered in a drawing to be held during Friday's luncheon. And tonight, we have a welcome reception that will take place in this ballroom at 5:30. Again, we're really excited to have you here. Before we get into the formal program, I want to ask our board member and employee of the City and County of San Francisco, Barry Frazier, to come up and welcome you to his town.
Well, welcome to San Francisco. This is just a very exciting moment for me. I'm delighted to see everyone here. I see a lot of old faces. I see a lot of new faces. I just wanted to formally welcome you to San Francisco and just let you know that the hotel here is actually, if you like walking, the hotel is excellently placed because you can go out and you can go across the street and you've got world-famous Chinatown. You can go left and take Kearney down a few blocks and you hit Market Street and you've got all the public transportation, BART, Muni, everything is right there and you're able to jump on and basically go anywhere in the Bay Area. If you go down to California Street and take a right, you go right down to the Embarcadero and the Bay, and you can catch the F Street trolley. It'll take you to Fisherman's Wharf, very easy. And if you want to take a little longer walk, you can go the other direction on California, and then hit Powell Street and go down Powell Street, and you're at Union Square, and there's enough shopping there to last you as long as you're here. But Ken did ask me to remind you that these streets are all closed during the conference sessions. So you have to stay here during the conference. But as soon as the conference sessions are over, there's lots of things to do. If you have questions about a restaurant or about how to get somewhere, look me up. There's several other folks from San Francisco in the Bay Area here. Feel free to ask us questions. We have SFGTV who are recording some of the sessions for webcast. They'll be happy to answer questions that you have too. So welcome again, and look forward to having a great conference. Thanks.
So let's get started. Our first two speakers are Mayor Joe Reardon from Kansas City, Kansas, and Rick Witt from Google. How many people in this room participated in some way in trying to get Google to come to your community? Okay, so we all know about the program. I was talking to Rick a little bit before the session started, and while there are many people here who perhaps were disappointed when Mayor Reardon got the prize, I think a lot of us recognize that Google did something really good here and awakened the possibilities for all of us to think about new and creative ways that the public sector and the private sector can partner in expanding the deployment and ultimately the usage of broadband throughout our communities. And while we're going to be doing later in the conference our community broadband awards, I need to remind everyone that one of those awards this year is going to this partnership specifically because Google has, in their choice of Kansas City, Kansas, has shown us and has shown the country that there are creative opportunities out there for the public and private sector that we haven't really explored yet. And hopefully the success of that project will lead to a great many more successes for the rest of us. So briefly, I will tell you that Mayor Joe Reardon is serving in his second term as the mayor of the unified government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas. He was elected to this second term in 2009. This will come as a surprise probably to no one, but his second term has been focused on what many of us are focusing on in our community, which is jobs and dealing with the economic downturn and unemployment, foreclosures, declining property values, all of those things, I will tell you from personal experience, make the job of a mayor very, very difficult. And Mayor Reardon has been a leader in looking for new and innovative ways to create jobs in his community, and the Google project is just one example of that. So we're really, really glad to have him here today. And then Rick Witt is the Washington, D.C. Telecom and Media Council for Google. Rick has participated with NATOA before, so he's not a stranger to us. He's responsible for the company's wireline, wireless, and media advocacy before the FCC and other federal agencies and Congress. Before he joined Google in 2007, he founded and headed the Net's Edge Consulting, which was a public policy consulting firm providing legal analysis, regulatory strategy, and advocacy counsel to web-based companies. So rather than reading the long and very impressive bios of both these gentlemen, I think we'd all like to hear from them. So I'm going to ask Mayor Reardon and Rick to come up, and please join me in welcoming them to NATOA.
Appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of Google. It's good to see you all again. I wanted to share with you just a couple of thoughts about how and why Google got involved in this whole concept of trying to build gigabit communities. One of the ironies here is that in this particular case, public policy advocacy actually was out in front of commercial operation. Many folks don't realize that the genesis of this idea for the management team at Google really started out with filings we made at the Federal Communications Commission as part of the National Broadband Plan, going back several years now when the FCC was taking comments on ideas on how to spur the deployment and uptake of broadband in this country. So our submissions there had some big ideas about how government should do a whole variety of things to encourage broadband. We talked about things like installing broadband fiber and conduit as part of every federal construction project that's going on, particularly highway projects in this country, which seems like a no-brainer, but unfortunately it's still bottled up on Capitol Hill for a variety of reasons. Deploying broadband high-speed fiber to every anchor institution, so libraries, schools, health centers, community centers, etc. Again, something that I think many people believe would be a really important step, particularly for serving communities where there are difficulties in terms of costs of broadband, to bring broadband to the home, having anchor institutions there, both in terms of having capacity available for people to use, and also to develop the digital literacy and the skills necessary to use broadband would be a positive thing. Some of that has been funded by the BTOP program from the stimulus package, but frankly, there's a lot more that could be done there as well. For the most significant thing for purposes of today is we talked about, the federal government really needs to figure out how to demonstrate high capacity broadband. The government should get in there and put 1 gig demonstration projects in a variety of places around the country. So anyway, we developed this whole package, and one of the occupational hazards of working at Google is that when you go into a meeting with folks from the company, most likely you are not the smartest person in the room. In fact, most everybody else probably are. The intelligence is elevated a fair amount compared to yourself. So I went in and gave this presentation to senior management, including Sergey Brin, who's one of our co-founders. And he said, very solid, Rick, very impressive, I like these ideas. He said, but this thing about this test bed, he said, something about that puzzles me. He said, why are we asking the government to do this? He said, we are fortunate, we have the wherewithal. Why don't we actually go out and build it ourselves? And it was sort of an aha moment for all of us, including several folks who work for Sergey, is to say, hey, yeah, that actually is a real possibility. So back in February of 2010, we announced our Think Big with a Gig concept. The plan about building to at least 50,000 up to 500,000 people in a particular community or several communities potentially at speeds of about 100 times faster than a typical broadband connection available today. So as many of you know, and we appreciate your participation in the process, we had the request for information. The response was overwhelming and frankly very humbling to us. We had something like 1,100 communities who applied, and also 200,000 individuals who nominated their communities, whether or not the communities themselves had actually put applications in. And the enthusiasm that was generated that we saw firsthand was telling as well. Communities and citizens, of course, they created websites, they held town hall meetings, they organized rallies, they filmed videos, they ran races, they jumped into shark tanks. In one case, someplace fairly close by to Kansas City, they changed their name for the day. And all this work, you know, we all took notice of this, and it made the process of reviewing the applications, frankly, even tougher because there were so many great, compelling options out there for us to choose from. So after this extensive vetting process, we announced this past spring we'll be deploying our high-speed broadband network to Kansas City, Kansas, and then to Kansas City, Missouri as well. And there are really three reasons primarily we chose these cities. And because we're an engineering-driven company, I can't tell you about all the spreadsheets and the 37 data points and algorithms and everything else we employed to look at a whole host of factors around topology and demographics and access to fiber conduit and the whole list of things. But at the end of the day, there really were sort of three factors that stood out with us in Kansas. First was we wanted to find a location where we could build quickly and efficiently. And so when we actually sat down and met with the folks in Kansas City, we realized not only did it have a very good infrastructure we could utilize and build upon, but that they were business friendly. They were eager and willing to work with us to find ways to make this happen, to bring this construction to the communities, to bring the jobs, to bring these services to their citizens for the first time. So simply put, as one of our project managers basically put it, Kansas City knew how to work at Google speed, so that was very much appreciated. Second, we wanted to build where we could make a real impact. So it wasn't a matter of us cherry-picking places where they were ideal, for example, upper-middle-class neighborhoods. Right? We wanted to have a mix of neighborhoods, a mix of demographics and folks of different economic means. And we wanted to be able to make sure this is a project that could boost economic development, that could create some educational gain with the educational institutions, anchor institutions I mentioned previously, and we had that in spades in the Kansas City area. And third, we wanted to develop a strong relationship with local government. We are a global company by nature. We are of Silicon Valley. We have data centers around the country. We have people who work around the country in various places. But it's fair to say we're not like a cable company or a telephone company. We don't really have people in a local community in the sense that we want to establish in Kansas City. And so we saw here the opportunity to build a multi-year relationship with the city, hopefully mutually beneficial, but something where we could really sort of dig our roots in someplace and try to demonstrate you know, as best we can that we could be a good partner and try to make the community a better place to live in. So Milo Medin will be speaking to you on Friday. He's the head of our fiber initiative, so I will not try to steal his considerable thunder. But I do want to say that, you know, so far working with the folks in Kansas City has been terrific. I've got several people on my team who work closely with Mayor Beard's staff and others there, and it's been a great relationship. Long way to go, though. We have not yet, you know, put spade in the ground, but it's coming very soon. We're hoping to be able to roll out the services quickly next year. And I guess just kind of a final point, you know, we saw the transition from dial-up to broadband in this country initially bringing in a new generation of companies like Netflix and Skype, YouTube, Twitter, our friends at Facebook, and countless other applications. We see really fiber and the ultra-high-speed broadband that can come from fiber as the next big leap in the internet. And we think it's not just going to be good for those companies that have kind of ridden the wave from dial-up to broadband. We think it's really going to be important for our people as consumers, as citizens, as family members, all the things that we kind of do, live and do every day, our hope, at least at Google, is the internet is going to be part of that fabric. It's going to actually make everybody's lives better. And having these high-capacity broadband networks, I think, is going to totally enable that, make that take off. So thrilled to be here today. Thanks again to the folks for having me, and turn it over to Mayor Beard for some of his thoughts on the project.
Thank you, Rick, very much. I'm just I appreciate being here with you all today. It's a very exciting conference, and I appreciate your willingness, Ken and everyone else, to invite me to say a few words. Cities know infrastructure, and we were like many of you at the beginning of this process and the 1100 that ultimately applied, and we realized the potential for this next generation of infrastructure to be very important to the quality of life of the city. It goes without saying for you all. In Kansas City, there are two cities that sort of sit right across from one another. A river separates part of our cities, but then we actually, a street is what the border ends up being. And our city is a city of about 150,000. And the city really grew up around the rail infrastructure that came to the Kansas City area and really created a hub for distribution from the Midwest, agribusiness, out to the entire United States. So there's a lesson learned, obviously, in Kansas City around what infrastructure can mean to the building of a city. And we kind of took that thought into the process of beginning to apply for and then ultimately applying for Google Fiber. And we were fortunate enough to be one of the two, with Kansas City, Missouri, coming out on the other end. I want to talk a little bit today about what this, because all of you have been through the process up to that point, but what's going on in Kansas City today, and what we see happening after the announcement, and kind of what we think will happen going forward, because that's the part that is new to all of us. And so what we saw happen in Kansas City is shortly after Kansas City, Kansas was announced, Google announced Kansas City, Missouri as being the second location for the installation. And the fortunate thing in that, and I think if you look at this infrastructure and the level of interest in it, and how fundamentally important that you all and I believe it is to the future of cities is, it offered the opportunity for these two cities that dwell in two different states but right next to one another to become closer in a vision about what the region was about. So Sly James, the mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, and myself started talking about how can we take the idea of installation of ultra-high-speed fiber to our homes and to our businesses and make a case for how this can propel our region forward. And in a way, I think that might be one of the most lasting things that we could offer to all the other cities, is that this can make a substantial difference in the way cities operate and the way regions can be successful, which I firmly believe, and I know that many of you do, and I think we're about and out to prove that that is the case. And we found an amazing amount of willingness from constituency groups throughout the region that had not otherwise been involved in the application or the initiative coming forward and wanting to be participants and a part of this. So we formed, not very long after the announcement, we formed the concept of creating a mayor's bi-state innovations team. The idea of bringing together thoughtful people that will think regionally about how you maximize the benefits of ultra-high-speed fiber widespread deployment in trying to create what we ultimately call the playbook for the two cities to operate on to figure out how you maximize the opportunities that will come, many of which none of us know what they would be. So how do you build a structure around that? We've appointed, and this was just announced 2 days ago, we've appointed a dozen folks in our city from both Kansas and Missouri sides to be that team. And Sly James and I have gone out to numerous constituency groups, from chambers of commerce on both sides of the state line, to other business interests, to economic development entities, and we've just found widespread engagement and willingness to explore with us what this opportunity really means. So as much as there was momentum around the announcement and excitement about it, there's an equal amount of energy from constituency groups that we hadn't really heard from a ton about this initiative today and going forward, and including folks like the Kauffman Foundation, which is headquartered in Kansas City, that focuses on entrepreneurialism and connecting that back to what's going on with the installation of ultra-high-speed fiber, which Google's working with us on. And so that's been a really rewarding experience, and we're just beginning to walk down that path. And we really started to take a look at those segments that you all know are important, not just economic development, but healthcare. And we've had engagement from our medical center and our university hospital around that. And we've had engagement on levels of education and libraries and really thinking around those lines. And so for a mayor in the current economy, what I can tell you from an elected body position, and some of you deal with this reality as well, cities are struggling with this economy in most every corner of the country. And we're trying to figure out how to make that next step work and sort of get the job done with limiting budgets and revenue that's not the way it should be. What this project has allowed us to do in this public-private partnership that we formed with Google is it's allowed our community to start thinking bigger again. And I, as mayor, I can tell you that I think that's very important to the future of our cities, that we allow individuals and institutions to think broadly about their futures and how they can work together to take those next steps, particularly now when the economy is so challenging and forces us to perhaps not think as big as we want to think. The final thing I'll say, and I think Rick and I are glad to answer a couple of questions if there are some, is that this we treated this walking in, and we're pretty proud in Kansas City, Kansas, a city of 150,000. We have really done some good things around economic development. And we've really tried to carry the idea of public-private partnerships into reality, and I think we've got a pretty good track record of that, most of those being bricks and mortar kinds of economic development that lead to permanent new jobs, which is so critical to our future. We took that learning and that approach and built a relationship with Google around it. And we found an absolutely willing partner on the private side that was willing to sit down with us and vision around the idea of the municipal entity trying to find out how we propel quality of life forward with this opportunity while understanding that Google has a business case to make and a job to do. And how you put those two things together and meld them was something that I think really worked well in our partnership with Google, and clearly what they were looking for with respect to diversity and the idea of opening up opportunity was something that fit well with us in our city of 150,000. Half of our population is minority, so we are very diverse both economically and ethnically as well. And so it really was something that worked well. And the final thing I'll say about this public-private partnership is that it's very dynamic and ongoing. So we're getting ready to put shovels in the dirt and all those sorts of things. But my sense of it is that this is a relationship that lasts a long time and that moves and is shaped by the opportunities that will come to us. And that's equally exciting. And I'm hoping that there's a lesson to be learned for cities around how you get this infrastructure more widely dispersed by way of public-private partnerships where you have a willing partner on the private side and a city that's willing to try to move quality of life forward and ways that perhaps we haven't before. So I'm very appreciative to be with you all here today, and I think we would stand for being respectful of time, a couple questions as well. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll repeat
the question or try to.
The idea was, or the question was, people follow progress going forward. We will have a website that's going to be dedicated to the fiber project. You'll start to be able to see like the first dig, the first micro trenching, the first drop of the first residential dwelling. In addition to that, one of the things that I want to stress is we're hoping to get out of this sort of a best practices approach in terms of, as Mayor mentioned, sort of the public-private partnership and how that works. It is an evolving process. Certainly a lot of learning has been done on our side just since the announcement. But I think it would be really, in our minds, it's beneficial to try to bring the learnings that we kind of take away from this in terms of working with cities and other municipalities to develop these kinds of infrastructure projects that hopefully others can take advantage of. And whether you attract us to the next generation of the Google Fiber project or hopefully many other entrepreneurs out there willing to take a chance on it, the idea is to try to move the dialogue forward and give people the tools necessary to try to attract the center of the best.
From the Bi-City Innovations team, we have partnered with the Mid-America Regional Council, which is our regional planning entity in the Kansas City region. And the team just got, literally, we just announced the team a couple days ago. But their intention is to have a website that would be up and running in the near term to talk about how we're working with the different business and educational and healthcare aspects to sort of build this playbook. So we see that very much as a dynamic process that will be out there and available in a public way. And so I would anticipate before the end of the year, you would see a website, probably somewhere around the Mid-America Regional Council's website that would talk about the initiative and have details there.
So the question was competitive response from existing providers. To this point, I think they've been taking a wait-and-see attitude. We've certainly not seen any strong signs of obstruction coming from them, which is great. I mean, we're hoping that they can see the benefits as well. We're trying to spur them along as well as others to be building out bigger, faster pipes. So, it's competition, and we'll see. But so far, I think it's been a fine working relationship with the incumbents that are there already.
Thank you all very much.
What a dynamite way to start off. All right, and the hits keep on coming. So I am really, really honored and privileged to introduce to you our next speaker. It's so exciting to have Craig Newmark here. Craig is the founder of Craigslist, the web-based platform that has fundamentally changed classified advertising. Any of you who didn't know that have been living in a cave. Since its founding in 1995, Craigslist has become one of the internet's 10 most visited English language sites. Craig hails from Morristown, New Jersey, which makes him one of my boys. Got a couple of Jersey people in here. Thank you, Eric. Actually, his high school and my high school were big rivals. He attended Case Western Reserve University, earned a BS and an MS in computer science. He's worked during his business career with IBM, Charles Schwab, Bank of America, and other firms. Today, he resides in San Francisco's Coal Valley. In March of this year, Craig launched Craig Connects, which is his initiative to link up everyone on the planet, so if you're not on it yet, you should be, using the internet to bear witness to good efforts and to encourage the same behavior in others, what many of us try to do in our day-to-day jobs with local governments. Craig regularly communicates through Twitter, through Facebook. He blogs regularly, and he's a contributor to the Huffington Post, so many different ways to keep in touch with him, and the best way to reach him is through the Craig Connects website, which is craigconnects.org. Craig is going to come up and speak. He's going to take some time for questions afterwards. The easiest way for us to do this will be for you to write down questions, if you have any, on the papers that you have at your tables, and Natoa staff and board members will collect them, and we will present them to Craig, and he'll pick the good ones to answer. So it is my great pleasure to ask Craig to come up and speak to us. Craig, thank you so much for being here.
Okay. I'm Craig Newmark, and I'm a nerd. In high school, the whole plastic pocket protector thing, the thick black glasses, which literally were taped together during two periods, and the social skills to go with that. Being introduced, saying something about being exciting makes me nervous because I prefer to be the opposite of exciting. An engineer by training, I just prefer to get stuff done. The deal, though, with being a nerd, especially in this culture, fulfilling that cultural cliche, what that means is that in high school, I do remember what it feels like to be left out, to be disenfranchised. You know, my memories, you know, that's an exaggeration. There are people in the world who had much worse years than I did, but I still remember. I embrace the notion, the feeling that I did feel left out, and that pretty much affects everything I do right now. Part of being a nerd also means taking things pretty literally. So in Sunday school, when they said the biggest thing to remember was to treat people like you want to be treated, I actually remembered that and took it much more explicitly as Craigslist started becoming a real thing years ago. Also, something I've recently realized as I work more and more with government, mostly in Washington, is that the ways of my people are very different than the ways of Washington in particular. There's a lot of nuance, subtlety, diplomacy that I don't quite get. And I had this same conversation yesterday in Washington, talking about some of the activities where we want to help military families and veterans. More on that a bit. But this affects me a lot, and that's me speaking personally. Well, I'm Craig Newmark, and I'm a customer service rep. Now, I haven't done any for about 40 minutes or so, but that's what I do. The whole idea with Craigslist is that, you know, way back, well, when I was working for a lot of big companies, you know, I was pretty frustrated. At IBM, I was a systems engineer for 11 years, and that's pretty much a technical customer service rep. And I wanted to help customers out, wanted to try to treat people like I want to be treated. That didn't work out so well. But IBM, by the way, is a very different company now, changed a great deal. But back then, you know, I wanted to treat people well. But working with big companies, I learned that often customer service is given lip service, that even while big companies are saying that they're focusing very heavily on providing better customer service, sometimes some of their people will talk to me and let me know that what their actual policy is to withdraw from a customer service as much as they could. And, you know, we all sometimes try to deal with big companies who commit to good customer service, wireless providers sometimes, and then when you try to call them, sometimes you get the opposite. But I decided years ago rather than whining about bad customer service, I would just try to do the best customer service I could. So over the years, what happened is that, you know, I got to San Francisco, working at Charles Schwab, going around the company in 94 saying, hey, here's the internet. We're going to do business this way someday. So a lot of people helping each other out. That was pretty good. And by the time early 95 rolled around, I figured, well, I should do something to give back. I started a simple list about events, you know, mostly technology events, sometimes arts and technology events. You know, the deal was that I figured this was my crude way of giving back, because 95 was a good year to be here if you were technologically inclined. This was the beginning of the big dot-com bubble. A lot of excitements. People were doing launch parties for dot-coms, spending way too much money on them, although I enjoyed the big platters of shrimp in particular, and missed that. Although now and then you still can get sushi. But it was fresh shrimp, too. And so this was the kind of atmosphere, the kind of thing that was happening back then. But there I was. I started this little events list. But what I did was unusual, because I asked people, hey, how should I do this? What's the right way to do this? I want your feedback. And people started saying things like, well, let's see if we can put jobs on there. And people had stuff to sell sometimes, like an older Mac they no longer had a need for. With the bubble coming up, I said, hey, there's an apartment shortage growing in San Francisco, so if you know something, let me know about that. Worked out pretty well. And that became a pattern which we continue to this very day. What happens is that people suggest stuff to us, we figure out what makes sense to do, and then we try to do it. Some things aren't doable, and sometimes people pose a dilemma to you. And the biggest story on my side in this regard is, has had to do with animal sales. Because from the beginning, there's a lot of people who feel that you should be allowed to breed animals at home and then sell them. And then a lot of other people who think this is a horrible thing to do to animals. No resolution. But the deal is that we began a cycle of listening and doing something about it. Not just talking about listening, but actually listening and acting, even when it's really hard to do. So that was just, again, that was just me, though, for a few years, way back in the, mid-late 90s. And at some point, you know, I even tried working with volunteers. That didn't work out so well. So around 99, I said, hey, I got to make this into a real company. Because I'm no entrepreneur. And, you know, I don't know if I have any real vision. But I figured, well, I'll make this into a real company, start hiring some folks. And one of the first things I did was I talked to friends who are investment bankers or venture capitalists. And they said, well, if I went the usual Silicon Valley route, I could monetize the thing like crazy and someday sell it and make maybe $1 billion. Now, I'm a nerd. I have what I call nerd values, meaning sometimes you got to know when enough is enough. As a programmer, I think, well, I'm still amazed, like a lot of other programmers, that people are willing to pay a programmer a lot of money for the exercise of one's craft. That's fun. But I figure, now this isn't about me. You know, I thought I could have everything I want, provide for my future, that of my family, by not monetizing like crazy, but just running it like a serious business. And you know, my model, my business model, was already doing well by doing good. And that's not altruistic. That's not noble. It's not pious. It just feels right. So again, the model, doing well by doing good, not monetizing like crazy. And that's why the site is almost all free. The key in there was that sometime in the early 99, I was asking people, both online but in person, coffee houses or whatever, conferences, what's the right way to pay the bills and maybe do some better? And they said, charge people who otherwise paid more for less effective advertising. So that's the deal. The strongest consensus was charge employers and recruiters for job postings. And they also said, charge sometimes in a category which had enforcement problems. We've done very little of that. But that works. You charge a nominal sum. Often you lose money on stuff like that, but sometimes it is the right thing to do. So that, in a sense, that's a big chunk of our history. We got going. By 2000, well, I realized that, well, friends helped me understand that my skills as a manager are limited, which is to say, as a manager, I suck. But fortunately, I had hired this guy, Jim Buckmaster, as a senior guy, and he runs things now. The deal there was that right around then, too, I stopped doing software. I stopped programming, which still makes me sad, because that's, you know, what I was trained to do, and that's what my temperament points me towards. But, we were hiring a team. Everyone was better at tech than I was. I wasn't needed in management, not really. But I was already doing customer service. I had been doing customer service since day one. And so at that point, I went into full-time customer service. And I committed myself to customer service. And I committed myself only as long as I live. After that, it's over. But again, I haven't done any customer service now for, let's say, under an hour. My team doesn't need me anymore, so I just these days do some of the simpler stuff, but also some things like, well, when someone's trying to run a phishing scam, I can tell that. And doing customer service has given me something of an enforcement mentality, which will pop up in other areas. So we just keep plugging away with Craigslist. A lot of things going on in that people keep asking me to do more. But the idea is that I'm a customer service rep. That's the primary thing I do at Craigslist. I just keep plugging away. Not fancy stuff, because people don't need fancy. People need fast and simple. And that works out pretty well. But again, this doing well by doing good mission, well, it kind of permeates what we do. And even as back as far as 10 years, people were asking me personally, hey, get involved in this nonprofit or the other. And I would do that. Sometimes I get involved in trivial ways, like lending my name to something. Sometimes I get involved in substantive ways, which pretty much always involve social media. Even before it was called social media, I would help people with the means of getting the word out. More crude back then, more sophisticated now. But you know, I may not know a lot about social media, but since there's so much demand for social media expertise these days, and so few people who are real experts, that I'm an expert in comparison. Although in some places people will bring me in even when they don't need me, but so I can frighten their management into taking things seriously. I do not mind being used as an oddity or curiosity if it helps. Yeah, I have decided to give up on that dignity thing. And often you wonder when I'm kidding or being serious, and sometimes the answer is yes. So I started working with different nonprofits over this last decade or so. Earlier this year, I had the sense that, you know, I couldn't tell you who I was, what advisory boards I was on anymore. I lost track. Three full boards, but mostly advisory. So the deal is that I asked a coworker to make a list, a spreadsheet of the stuff. And when she was done, I thought it would be 20 to 30 nonprofits and public service work too, governmental organizations. I tend to conflate them because they're all about helping people. So I thought I'd see 20 or 30 entries, closer to 100. And that's disturbing because I really like to have my act together. But at that point I said, well, I'm helping all these groups. I should make a bigger deal of it. I should publicly stand up for the stuff I believe in. Both the causes implicit in this, and I want to find a better word than causes, it sounds too fancy. I'm sitting in for causes and then specific efforts, although the overarching theme is technology for good. The deal is to use real technology for real results. You know, good intentions are required, but good intentions without the ability to actually get something done, that's not so useful. And I'm not as patient as I should be with only good intentions, so you'll forgive me if that ever comes up. So the idea is that I started this Craig Connects thing. The immediate goals were to stand up for the stuff I believe in and the specific groups who are good at it, and then also try to inspire people to do other related work that means stuff for them. In my head, I'm thinking that in 20 years or so, I want this kind of stuff to be happening over the entire planet. People standing up for whatever they believe in, whatever their individual visions of the common good are. But I figured I'd start with my own stuff. And that's not so bad. Overarching theme, again, real technology to get real stuff done. And the biggest flash, because I've just done a great deal of it, very recently, is for military families and veterans. It comes down to, if someone's willing to go overseas to risk taking a bullet for me, well, at least I can give some of my time and money. This also... this also has to do with, I actually grew up, high school during the last couple of years of the Vietnam War, saw vets treated pretty shabbily, and my dad served in the Pacific, I think mostly blowing things up. And so I figured I could do something and started learning about these groups. And here's a sub-theme. Sometimes you want to help out national groups doing good things for the whole country. And sometimes you focus on the local. So I'm working a lot with the Department of Veterans Affairs and involved in a few innovation initiatives, like how you can provide better medical care, sometimes at hospital, sometimes for a wounded warrior at home. Because if you're stuck in a hospital, you know, for a year, if you're in a bed, you have an enormous sense of isolation. Same kind of isolation as if you're a person who's 50, 60, 70 living at home without someone living in the home. This is a big deal. It's more than just wounded warriors. It's anyone who doesn't have close contact. You're living alone, whether you're in a big city or you're in a rural area. The deal is that there are a lot of people housebound for medical reasons or whatever. And of course, there's lots of troops deployed across the world who are part of platoons or whatever, but they're still a long way from their family. So that's the kind of things I think about, because something that I think is pertinent here is that, well, one of the things I've worked with at the VA is the notion that right now there's a lot of medical instrumentation coming out which is fairly smart. It can talk Bluetooth, which could talk using Bluetooth to a smartphone or a tablet or a desktop system or a notebook, which would in turn talk to a medical records database and, you know, send updates up there which your doctor could then look at. This is a big thing for vets, and I'm involved in a Veterans Affairs Innovation Initiative along these lines. Big thing, and I think this applies to the folks here. The deal is that one need for broadband everywhere in the country will be for people who are housebound, who need that kind of remote medical attention. They'll need it to connect to their families, they'll need it to connect to caregivers, and they may connect to the community that they have around them. Because you find what I figure will be the right kind of tablet with the right kind of small amounts of training and with help from local cable companies or whatever. The deal is that you can remove or reduce the sense of isolation that a lot of people have. Now, my mindset there starts with, vets who are at home still recovering, or maybe they're World War II vets who need some extra medical attention. But the idea is that these are really good uses for broadband across the whole country, which people don't talk about. A related one, talking about military families and deployed troops, are that it really makes a big difference if the family of a troop could do video over the net talking to the troop. And this is a real thing that happens now, but I have a feeling in rural areas where you don't have broadband, that's a problem. So the Department of Veterans Affairs is also doing a whole bunch of things. One theme also, briefly, is that in any large organization, the people who are the frontline workers, the customer-facing people, know how to do things better, often, know what's going on, and how to do better than the boss does. In the late 80s, I was trained in business process reengineering, and that's what we're talking about. The people on the front lines can tell you how to do things better. They can eliminate unnecessary steps and figure out how to do other steps better. Business process reengineering, and they're trying it at the Department of Veterans Affairs, one effect can be getting a check to a vet faster when it comes to a medical claim. That's the big stuff. The small stuff matters in a big way. And in town, we have the City College of San Francisco. Big school, there are about 1,000 vets working there on the student, on the GI, the new GI Bill. So they're getting some help there. But you know, when you're a vet coming back, you know, you want to work and socialize and just be able to chat with other vets. The bottom line is I helped build the Student Vets Lounge at the City College of San Francisco and paid some attention to also the networking aspects of the thing there. Avanes, in the kind of in the middle of town, there's now the Veterans Resource Center. Same kind of deal, where vets can get together. And the theme is that they needed broadband, helped with some of that. Related thing, and pretty close to here, is the Tenderloin Technology Area, which is a joint effort involving the St. Anthony's Church, which also runs one of the biggest cafeterias for homeless people, one of the biggest ones in the country. But they run a computer lab to help vets and others to actually find out how to use the internet to get a job and that kind of stuff. The idea is that broadband is used on a daily basis for all sorts of valuable stuff, and we're just trying to extend that and to try to extend that even further. I was speaking at University of Texas Arlington a few weeks ago, and you know, they have a lot of student vets. Maybe they need this kind of thing. Now, sometimes it needs help because the Tenderloin Technology Lab, being in an underserved neighborhood, the Tenderloin, well, there were no cable services down that block, but to their credit, I just asked Comcast, hey, can you lay that cable down there? And that happened. That's mighty good. So the deal there is that this kind of stuff works. A lot of these common things spring from efforts to support military, military families and veterans. A lot of things happen along those lines. And frankly, along the lines of technology for good, you take a look at donorschoose.org. They're about, if you're a teacher and you have a project you need funded in your class, you can put the project up there and ask people to fund it maybe 20 bucks at a time. And sometimes the project is get enough paper and pens so that the teacher's project could be funded. And there's a lot of schools which primarily serve military families. So I did a matching grants thing for that, announced the results yesterday, and just about 20,000 students were helped in this effort. This was not only me funding, but I got several hundred other people to help out with this thing. So these things are big things, they're real things, and they're all revolving around the use of the internet and broadband technology. There's a lot of other areas that I get involved with this kind of thing. A lot of causes on CraigConnects.org. But again, a lot of the theme is technology for good. Donors Choose is one example. Another example is Kiva.org, which is based in town here. The idea there is microfinance. If you find a business overseas, you know, sometimes they just need $1,000 to get a real business going. And you know, someone with a job doesn't want to fight usually. So the idea is that that's a good way you can help out projecting real American values in other parts of the world. Kiva, though, has also just started funding in places like Detroit. And I spent 10 years in Detroit as part of my IBM career. So I figured I'd do a little bit of that, too. So we have a lot of these groups, a lot of nonprofits who really do really good stuff. And the idea is that I'm pointing out these things. They need help with social media, that kind of thing. Now also, one other area I'm helping with is that, well, we all want to help out at times. And usually the way you help out is through a nonprofit of some sort. Now we know there's a lot of good nonprofits out there. Most of them are pretty good. Some of them not so good. Because sometimes you read about a nonprofit who spends all their money on salaries for the people or fundraising. And maybe there's a little bit left out to help out their clients. There are nonprofits out there, though, who literally spend nothing on their clients. It's all salaries and, just some fundraising expenses, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing which people normally think about as a scam. Now, again, I don't like to whine about a solution, so instead, what I found is that there's a couple groups who've been around a long time. Guide Star, and Charting Navigator. The deal is you go to these guys, and what they can do is help you figure out the financial soundness of nonprofits. Now, there's well over a million of them, but what they do is they focus on the nonprofits that actually get money from people. You know, those are the active, more active nonprofits. So the idea is that you can go to Charting Navigator and GuideStar and look at that. But what we really want is ways that the effectiveness of nonprofits can be measured. You know, are they really serving their client population? Now, both groups are working on that right now. And yesterday, and by yesterday I mean yesterday, Charity Navigator just announced new measurements of accountability and transparency. And they also revealed more about their plans on finding better ways people can better rate nonprofits by training a whole bunch of volunteers. I mean, a whole bunch. So the deal is that these groups are actually working on stuff which can help us out in this area, because we need help taking out the effective nonprofits, and you know, we need to be warned when the nonprofit is fundamentally a scam or something like the director is taking like $1 million salary or more, because those are real things. Now those things were, you know, the real effectiveness of nonprofits, what they can do, that's a future. But there's a group in town here called greatnonprofits.org. Their deal is that they're user reviews for nonprofits. And, you know, so it's just like Yelp for nonprofits. That's good and bad, mostly good, but like any user review system, it can be gamed. And the problem with that is that, well, gaming a system, you know, it's something I know about, so I'm helping out with that kind of thing. So all these activities have to do with real technology being used for, you know, real help. You know, and usually my mode is where I'm helping the helpers. With Craig Connects is that I'm standing up for the causes that I believe in, you know, the stuff that I believe in, and trying to help out with them in some meaningful ways. One area which I'm actively doing but not yet talking about is that, you know, I would like the news to be something I could trust again. And I'm inspired by the best news team in America, by the most trustworthy newsman in America, Jon Stewart, and The Daily Show. Remember that you can't tell when I'm kidding or not, but I'm completely serious. They do the best fact-checking. They're still doing fact-checking. And they also point out, let's say, problems elsewhere. So these guys are good at it. And I figure, again, I'm not going to whine or complain about it. I'm working with folks with the idea of restoring traditional journalism values back to news organizations. The big ones, fact-checking. But there's also the deal where, you know, news outlets are supposed to separate reporting from advertising and other financial considerations. Little help needed there, too. So the deal is, this is serious. For a hint of the way things are, look at politifact.com and factcheck.org. You know, take them with a grain of salt, because everyone has biases, and PolitiFact is a little too literal for my taste. As a nerd, I'm supposed to be the literal one, you know, and I want to tell PolitiFact, like, get off my lawn. But that's being actively worked on, so that's a hint of the future. But all of this means using social media, real stuff, to really help out. And sometimes you wonder, Facebook, Twitter, Google+, is this stuff a passing fancy, or is this stuff for real? And so I've looked back in history a bit, trying to figure out, you know, are there examples of social media in the past that have had durable, lasting results? So I've looked a lot at a couple of bloggers whose work really contributed a lot, Tom Paine and Ben Franklin. These guys got results, and it worked. So I'm thinking that they used the internet of their time, printing press, plus the proto post office, and coffee houses. Coffee houses actually play a large role in distributing pamphlets, their kind of blogs. You know, caffeine is a very powerful technology. And by the way, it's much more powerful than people credit it, because, you know, prior to the American Revolution, there were bloggers like John Locke hanging out in coffee houses, but John Locke's writing led to Tom Paine and Ben Franklin and their own revolution. And I'm thinking of the John Locke who lived several hundred years ago, not the John Locke I'm lost. But speaking as a guy who knows some quantum physics, I understood the ending of Lost. Well, particle physics helps too. But, you know, these guys had their own inspiration, and going back a little further, I learned about a guy named Gutenberg, who's a nerd. Didn't really know how to make really effective use of this technology. That led, you know, that only happened about 60 years later with a social media wonk named Martin Luther. And he knew what he wanted to say, and he blogged. And he not only used a printing press, but he had a store and forward network of churches. Now, the lesson of Luther is that when you use social media, you lose control of your message right away. And that's why we have a lot of Protestant denominations. And Gutenberg's lesson is that if you're a technologist, you're responsible for your own media. You know, he's gotten good press in retrospect, but, you know, that's a few hundred years too late. Okay. Now, the thing is that Martin Luther made use of the store and forward network and the inspiration of a much earlier, very successful social media guy named Paul of Tarsus, or St. Paul. He built the church store and forward network, and he also invented something which I call email, short for epistle mail. And his efforts worked. The deal is that what we're talking about with the internet is not new. The internet just allows us to do a lot more of connecting to people faster. It's ubiquitous. You know, with smartphones, we carry the internet around in our pockets. So we have better tools for all this stuff, a lot better. But it's not that different than we had in the past. The thing is, the kind of social change using social media in the past could take hundreds of years to happen. But now, I feel it's being compressed into around 10 years, this decade, because right now, Washington is an attempted beehive of social media activity. A lot of people are doing it, but actually, you know, they're doing a lot of hiring. That's what people are trying to do. So the deal is that this stuff, you know, this technology can be used for serious, durable, lasting good. And you guys are in the business. So, you know, I'd like you to help me out. You know, take a look at CraigConnects.org. Humor me for a minute. You'll see what I'm doing. You'll see a change soon, too, because we're revising the site to make it more direct and to the point. But, you know, you can go through there, look at the causes that I'm doing and the specific groups that I'm helping. If the cause and the specific groups, if you like them, what you can do is donate time or money, or just go to their Facebook pages and do a like and share what they do sometimes. Use the Facebook share thing or the Google Plus share thing. Retweet what they do. That kind of thing works. Tangentially, I'll say that you see me retweeting a great deal for two reasons. It's good to share, and retweeting spares me from the burden of original thought. But this kind of stuff really does help. It really does matter to them, this range of things. If the cause moves you, like veterans, but you know, maybe help out the local veterans in your area, because they're all over the place. I'm guessing there's 15,000 or so veterans efforts throughout the country. A lot of them are local ones, city, county, or whatever. A lot of them are nonprofits. Help them out. Also, if you like and use a charity, you know, either you've been the recipient in the past, or you know the people, you volunteer, maybe you're on their board, go to greatnonprofits.org and write a review for that nonprofit. The idea is that this all is serious help. These are things that you can do. Because, you know, I think that this decade really is one of the most important in human history. the idea is that people are using social media to get real change happening. This is really happening, and we're seeing a balance, a rebalancing of power between the people who've always had money and power and between the groups of people with good intent who work together, people who also know how to get things done. And, you know, everyone here can be a part of that, and I sure appreciate that. Thanks, folks. The idea of sending questions on paper or whatever means that, well, brevity is the soul of work, soul of wit, and I can do more of them.
So if you have questions in writing, just raise your hand, and board members or staff, please help us collect them, bring them up here.
I will.
I don't see any board members. Get it, Jody. Thank you. Okay, let's go, guys.
I will be biased towards the ones where I have funny material to respond with, although, as the girlfriend reminds me, I'm not as funny as I think I am. Of course, that's a Y chromosomal characteristic, I feel. People are pointing out that hearing the term nerd is not an easy experience. Am I involved with youth groups to let them know that nerd is cool, and I'm not. I would like to find a way to do that. I would like to find a way to transmit that message. Now, that message is kind of going through our culture already. Being a nerd or geek is cool. A basic message is simply that if you're a kid in school and you're school smart, but maybe not emotionally smart, tell your kid not to show off in school, because that's going to lead to a living hell. Now, again, it's not as hellish as I remember, but again, if you have a kid who's bright or knows someone or, you know, relative, tell them not to show off, because they're just going to screw themselves, basically. Yeah. And again, you'll hear much more about geek chic than nerd chic. Not the same, but the deal is that they're close enough for most conversations. How would Craigslist and my other work be enhanced by a gigabit last mile network? I don't know, because our site's optimized to be very fast with lots and lots of caching and stuff like that. Most of the innovation in the site is with caching to keep it fast, stuff you never see. But the deal is that, our history is that when I started, you know, the early adopters, the people in the industry, were using 56 kilobit modems. I was using an ISDN line. But thinking about the people who had 14 kilobit access. So we optimized for that. So I don't have a good answer for the gigabit stuff. Now, I've actually worked with Blair Levin, formerly FCC. Last I saw him was at Aspen Institute, talking about some of this, and video. Job training, people talking with each other that, you know, are isolated and need to reach out. You know, in all humanity, those are the people who are going to need it the most. Now, they may need it also for stuff like Facebook, because you know, they want that to be fast. Because, you know, the gateway application for a lot of people might be video chat with their grandchildren. And this is mundane, but it's real. Do I regret Craigslist's impact on newspapers? Most of our impact is an urban myth. The real problem, well, see, I speak to a lot of publishers and editors, journalists. I remind them that I know that I'm not in the business, and I'm not going to tell them how to do their job. But speaking as an eager news consumer, the problem really is loss of trust, which is why news in any media is having problems right now. Again, I don't want to whine about it. Instead, I prefer to be part of the solution, and that's happening. You got to tell me when to stop, too. Okay. Community television values a social media tool. I don't know specifically on the community side, but just in general, you know, pretty much anyone can do video now and can do a video broadcast now. And that works out pretty well. You know, so everyone can use it. The hard part is, well, it's so easy. How do you find good stuff among all the other stuff? And I don't know. For me, it's been word of mouth. Other people will curate suggestions for me, often through a Twitter. And I just started listening to This Week in Google with Jeff Jarvis, and that's pretty good. Now, I tend to listen to the audio because that works well enough for me. But the deal is that anyone can do this now and use it for whatever purposes they want. Social media for philanthropy or for a business. Just go ahead and use it. Experiment with it. I need to do a better job of that. I'm not doing a good enough job of that. So that's something we can all do. And because, you know, most notebooks these days have cameras built in. And to buy a webcam, oh, they're cheap now. Bandwidth caps about discriminating about discriminating against gaming and other form, and are they at an unfair advantage? I don't know how this applies to sports, frankly. I've never thought about that part. It does relate to the whole net neutrality thing. And for the most part, I've not talked about net neutrality recently because there's too many people talking about it already. I just point out that when you're using a cable cutting across public land or private land, you know, that's using, you know, property from the public, or if you're using the airwaves, I figure that's public property as well. So if you're going to use public property, you know, there's certain American values like a level playing field and fair play. Just sometimes respect that. That's all I can think of, is that we are on all this together. So when it comes to this kind of thing, you know, let's think about shared values, about what works for people, and that works for me. How are customer service and programming alike? Not really alike at all, with one possible tenuous exception. When you're writing code, you're going to come back to that code a year later, or someone else is going to come back to that code and look at it. And if you wrote the code in a way that only you could understand it when you're writing it, you've kind of screwed yourself, and the person is going to have to maintain it in the future, which is to say, write code that another human can maintain, and that's an act of compassion more than customer service. Okay. Given my narcissistic approach to domain names, I am going to need leave names for the rest of us, written by another Craig. The history of the name Craigslist in mid-95, when, to start, I had been using a really advanced email tool at the time called Pine. And I was using CCList to get stuff out. Broke at about 250 email addresses. So I had to use a listserv, you know, major domo, had to give the thing a name. But back then it was almost all San Francisco events. And I was going to call it SF events. But people who were around me, smarter than me, said, we already call it Craigslist. You've developed a brand. I didn't know what a brand was, but apparently I had one. And as they said, call it Craigslist. They were right, and it's worked. It signifies that the thing would be personal and quirky. And in some respects, that may be responsible for my decisions about business model, you know, doing well by doing good, not monetizing everything. And again, I don't need $1 billion. I have a really good shower. I have a small house, but with a lot of birds visiting me. And I love birds. And I have a regular place to park, which is a big deal in this city. Let's see. Programmers, nerds, techies, what can we do to disrupt the lock on the FedGov technology complex to get stuff done? This is a really complicated issue, but people are actually working on and solving that in a number of ways. Through the Office of the Country's CTO, CIO, they're working on ways to introduce, for example, open source technologies to things. It's a long story, and I'm not real good at articulating it, but particularly the CTO of Veterans Affairs, Peter Levin, and the CTO of Health and Human Services, Todd Park, are figuring out how to use private industry and open source methodologies to get stuff done in a hurry. It's really tough. They're working on a band from the GSA, which a lot of the people formerly are still in the Federal Web Managers Council, and they've been working on this for a few years. How do you actually serve the public better with federal websites? And as of 2 days ago, they launched a national conversation on how do you make websites better in a sense. And I blogged it on CraigConnects, and I'm actually actively a part of it on the customer service side. I'm trying to figure out how much I should type in versus how much I should get my own opinions in there. The idea is that right now what we're seeing is a real thing where people are talking about how does the federal government build websites that make things work better. Like one of the suggestions, which I think this has been around a while, but it's going to be more visible, which is on a website you should use plain language. You should talk like a regular person talking to regular people. And that's actually really big and novel in the federal government. And that's one of the problems I have in Washington where I frighten people. I've once frightened a lot of people by not using PowerPoint. And these were people who were a much better arm than I was and who worked at the Pentagon and Homeland Security. And I didn't quite know what I was getting into. Seriously. But the idea is that plain language is innovative in government. Also, the idea that, federal websites should be more like 311. This is something I mentioned years ago and got nowhere. But the idea is that you want to go to some place where they can help you figure out how you really want to get stuff done that you need to get done. And that's something we all need. San Francisco has 311 like that. So does New York. The deal is in government, you want to go to one place with phone or web or whatever, ask, hey, how do I get this done? Or you report a problem like a pothole, and then you get it done. People, by the way, if you ever look at C-Click-Fix, which you can run on your smartphone, you see a pothole or something, you take a picture of it, you geotag it, you type in a few words saying what's wrong, say submit, and it goes to the city department who can fix it. And someday they'll fix it. So that's the kind of thing which is happening now, and I'm finding a lot of people in government throughout the whole country who are getting involved with this stuff. Two of the hubs of this activity, well, there's techpresident.com and the Personal Democracy Forum conference that they run every year. And look at the government 2.0 stuff that Tim O'Reilly does. This stuff is real and happening, and everyone here, I think, can play a role in it. Dollar value estimate on all the for sale stuff on Craigslist. I don't have a clue. All I know is that, in a way, we've given away well over $1.5 to $2 billion good ads, like-kind contributions to the public. And I don't know how much the average value of a classified ad is worth, but multiply that, say, by $1.5 billion, and that's the value of the like-kind contributions we've made to the American public. Thinking traditional philanthropy among rich guys is they make a lot of money and give some of it away, sometimes a lot of it away. We figure, well, in our model, I want a person, well, let's suppose you're putting up a barter ad to put, to put food on the table. And, on Craigslist, people get jobs that way, places to live. A lot of free stuff gets given away on the site. Again, people sometimes only get through the day by bartering services. And the deal there is that we figured it's better to save someone the $40 or $100 or whatever that person would otherwise have to spend putting an ad on a newspaper site. Now, I'd rather the person keep that money because they know how to use it better than I do. So that's the closest way I can answer that thing. By the basic look of Craigslist looks the same. People who use the site say keep it simple and fast. Sometimes we improve the look and feel incrementally, but we're responding to community feedback. We do what people tell us they want and need us to do, and they tell us keep it fast and fight spam the best way we can. And the look and feel, you know, we try to keep it as simple as we can. That's something I'm struggling with CraigConnects, because you know, I'm trying to get it a little bit more focused, and I had that conversation with the design team yesterday. When will I start my own news network? Remember, I'm not in that business. I'm not even going to try. But maybe it'll be fun to be back on Stewart and Colbert, especially Colbert, because if I'm pushing fact-checking, that makes me the anti-Colbert. CraigConnects, help to the communities. How can we help you with my vision, whatever it is, and goals? The deal is, again, look at CraigConnects, support the causes there, support the individual groups, or just support the causes, or support what makes sense to you. You know, I would like you to like my Facebook fan page, but maybe you, you know, learn enough Facebook to build a fan page for local community groups that are around you, and that could work. Or a Craigslist Foundation has something called likeminded.org. The deal there is that a lot of people, neighborhoods, and communities figure out how to do something good for the community. And then you can write a description of how you did that something for your neighborhood or whatever. And then someone else in the world trying to figure out, you know, they how to do the same thing, or more or less, can look at like-minded and see the same thing being done, and maybe they can reproduce it. These things ain't bad and are doable. Why didn't it work out when I was just working with volunteers? Probably because I didn't exert enough leadership. I was busy doing contract programming, being paid a fair amount. That's what I was focused on. The value of Twitter, it's a good way to chat with each other, to tell people what's really going on in a place like the street in Egypt. It's a good way to get the word out for things. It's a people for casual people to casually chat, but sometimes to deliver real value, and sometimes get help. I've asked for help on tech stuff or whatever on Twitter. Even what's going on in New York when I visit, that works. Now, that may be the future, maybe not. We all got to stay agile with this stuff because things change. Michigan's nerd governor, I don't know enough about that, so I'll have to pass on that one. But actually, I would like to hear more about that to see if he's worthy of the title. Because if he's a politician and a nerd, this is some horrible chimera. You know, the idea that I, in San Francisco, there's a lot of work being done in genetic engineering, bioinformatics, genomics, and we're not incredibly far, a couple miles away from the Mission Bay campus of UCSF, not far away from the main campus, where they're also doing stem cell research. So I expect perhaps someday we there can create a hybrid of nerd and politician. But on the other hand, it could be ground zero for the next nasty epidemic. So that probably won't happen today, by the way. But you never know about tomorrow. Your joke about, Luther blogging and his message got a little distorted. How am I going to handle that with my new site? And I don't think Luther's message got so much distorted as when you talk to people and rely on them to get your message across. You know, human nature is that they're going to get it a little bit wrong just because they heard it wrong. They may relay it a little differently just because of their own belief systems. So whenever you're passing messages along, things change. So like the Barack Obama campaign a few years ago was using social media, and different people came up with their own variations of the message. The Tea Parties, Chris, there's actually a whole bunch of them, they have different messages. You know, it's not a monolithic block, so there's actually different splinters of the Tea Party movement. The deal is that when you have when you're using social media, as soon as you start using social media, you've lost control of your message. You don't want to try to control it, because that's only going to piss off people. Okay. 5 minutes, and let's see what we can do. You want to start your own business as a bit of a nerd. Make sure no one else is doing the same kind of thing. And make sure you have someone working with you, or you have somehow developed the skills to get attention for what you're doing, part of what's, and then have a way of connecting people to it, of getting people to actually use the thing. There's a lot of things going on, more and more, that are trying to get our attention, and to get through all the noise, that's harder and harder. That's advertising or promotion or marketing, whatever you like to call it, and it's not getting any easier. Craigslist growing in 5 or 10 years, more of the same. There'll be more cities, more languages. We'll try to address real needs better. There will be surprises that we don't have a clue about. Partnerships that we'd like to have in the future with community TV. That's not part of our model. We're not thinking about that. Someone may surprise us, and I'm receptive to surprises, but don't know. How many employees are Craigslist? I think there's 34 of us, although I've actually been in the situation where I give a talk, and when I check email again, there'll be more. The idea is to stay small, because the smaller an organization is, the better and more effective communication is among people. When you get a larger organization, and in a hierarchy, the deal is that people get ahead by telling their boss what the boss wants to hear, and then they tell their boss what they want to hear, so you got communication breaking down immediately, which is why you need employee innovation, wherein employees can use some online technologies to figure out what they're really doing and to make the boss see it. Am I doing anything around education and teaching? Not really, because a lot of other people are really doing something about that. And I figure I found a few areas where I can actually make a contribution. And so that's where my focus is right now. The closest I get is this Donors Choose thing, which is this modest educational thing. Again, when you're helping a teacher pay for paper, pens, that kind of stuff, when you're providing the dollars, rather than asking the teacher to pay for it out of their salary, and teachers are not paid much, they're kind of screwed. And you don't want a teacher paying for paper out of their own salaries. So donorschoose.org is a good thing. And again, if you look at my blog, again, craigconnects.org, you'll see, maybe not the latest entry, but you'll see something about donorschoose.org and focusing on schools that serve military families. But that's a big deal, and it's a good way to help out. And you know, if you have kids in a school, and it's a low-income school, well, I think I kind of recall, I think they said that 78, I'm losing the percentage figure, but most of the schools that I helped match funds for military kids, most of them are low-income schools. So this is a big deal. Folks, thanks. I appreciate it.
Craig, thank you so much. That was really great. And I just have to say personally, I first met Craig in 2008 during the presidential campaign. And sort of any of you who have had kids in their late teens or early 20s, you know that there comes a time in your kid's life where you're not cool anymore. And, you know, it used to be if your parent, like, knew a sports you know, a famous athlete or a rock star. You know, maybe you would be cool. And around the time of the convention in Denver in 2008, Craig and I both had film clips of that went out over the internet to support the Obama campaign. And I guess as proof that it's cool to be a nerd or it's cool to know a nerd, all of a sudden my kids started sending out email messages to their friends. And my dad's on a video with Craig. So thank you for that, Craig. So now we are at a really special time of our conference because I get the privilege of announcing our member of the year. This is the highest award that we give out on an annual basis. We are an organization of officers and advisors. Last year, our member of the year were officers, and this year, we have an advisor. Our member of the year is intelligent, he's sharp, his legislative advocacy skills are second to none. He is as passionate about our issues as anyone I have ever had the privilege to work with. He's well respected. I have asked him over the years to do a variety of things for NATOA. Not only has he never said no, but he has always said yes enthusiastically. And one other thing. Jody Miller, our board member who's a co-chair of the P&L committee, has been keeping track of who says the most words on the P&L call every month, and he won that too. So please join me in welcoming and thanking our member of the year, Jerry Lederer.
This is really nice and totally not expected. I remember when I was in high school, I gave a talk at the very end of my senior year, and it was the point of the talk was that if you get involved with something, it's amazing how you can find you might just fall in love with it. It's hard to talk to the folks here because you all are involved with the NATOA and you love it. You just need a couple few other people to date in NATOA and they'll fall in love too. So let's all go find some double dates for NATOA. Thank you very much.